Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Jurnov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it and play it later on your iPod, iPad, or whatever device you stored it on. Today we have a real interesting show as we delve into privilege and e-discovery. We always seem to get high-profile guests whenever we tackle privilege and e-discovery. In the past, we've had Tom Allman and Judge Grimm discuss Rule 502, and Judge Facciola talked about creative ways to approach privilege logs. And today's show is no exception as we bring David Greenwald, the author of the practice series Protecting Confidential Legal Information, and a partner at Jenner Blog, and Jonathan Redgrave, who's authored a number of law review articles on privilege as well. Now for the more formal introduction, David Greenwald is a partner at Jenner & Block Chicago office. He's the editor of the firm's Attorney Client Privilege Update online resource center, which provides regular reports on this legal issue. He's an accomplished trial lawyer concentrating on business litigation with particular emphasis on reinsurance arbitrations and litigation, derivatives litigation, domestic and international arbitrations, bankruptcy litigation, internal investigations, and government contracts litigation. David frequently speaks on insurance and reinsurance topics, including issues relating to the London insurance market and cross-border disputes. He also frequently speaks on topics related to attorney-client privilege, work product doctrine, and other testimonial privileges, particularly with respect to the work of in-house counsel and on e-discovery topics. David's publications include co-author of Testimonial Privileges, which was a Thompson West publication from 2010. He's co-author of Protecting Confidential Legal Information, a handbook for analyzing issues under the attorney-client privilege and work doctrine, work product doctrine, really a substantial number of books and chapters on this topic. David's also very active within the Sedona Conference, so I'm glad to have you finally on ESI Bytes.
Glad to be here.
And Jonathan Redgrave is a serial guest here on ESI Bytes. We're thrilled because he's also a true pioneer in the electronic discovery world, as well as the founder of several creative law firms who focus solely on information management, including his current law firm, Redgrave LLP. Almost anyone in the field knows that Jonathan's internationally recognized for his work. He's authored, co-authored, and edited numerous publications in the area of e-discovery, privacy, and data security, and has spoken around the world on these issues. Notably, Jonathan has extensive experience in all areas of complex litigation in state and federal courts and focuses his practice on information law matters. He regularly addresses issues involved in the discovery of electronically stored information, as well as issues concerning records retention and privacy policies and practices for clients. He's been recognized for exceptional standing in the legal community, Band 1 in the Chambers USA, America's Leading Lawyers for Business for 2010 for e-discovery. He helped define and was the first chair of and is currently chair emeritus of the renowned Sedona Conference Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production. He's also co-chair of the acclaimed Georgetown University e-discovery Institute. Previously, he was a member of Nixon Peabody's Commercial Litigation Practice Group, which focused on information law matters, and also partner with Jones Day in Washington, D.C., and Gray Plant and Moody. Also his previous virtual firm, Redgrave Daily, Reagan & Wagner. Did I switch the names there? I think I got them right. But he's got an exceptional background. Thrilled to have him on the show. And I like to always start off the programs by asking first how you got interested in electronic discovery. And David, since this is your first show, why don't you kick it off?
Sure, that's great. Well, I've worked on privilege issues for 25 years since I got out of school. As soon as I got to Jenner, our senior partner, Jerry Salvey, who unfortunately passed away just a month or so ago, asked me to work on what's now become a 400-page outline that was inspired by the Supreme Court's decision in Upjohn. And so I've worked continuously on issues of privilege. And as you've already indicated, I've worked on many, you know, complex pieces of litigation, as well as internal investigations, both criminal and civil. And as ESI has, exploded over the years. Issues of privilege come up, and they're particularly, poignant with regard to privilege and inadvertent disclosure. You know, the nightmare scenario in Rule 502 of inadvertently disclosing a privileged document and blowing the privilege with respect to everything related to it in an undefined way gave everyone nightmares. And so I was regularly asked to and, actively participate in plans for review of documents. And that led to my joining Jenner's e-discovery task force, where I get involved at the beginning of a lot of big cases, even if I'm not going to work on them, to plan for the privilege review as well as preservation and review for responsiveness.
And Jonathan, if you can remember back, when did you get involved in e-discovery?
Oh, back in high school when I used the first portable computer, the Osborne, which may people recall weighed a light 24 pounds. Really not quite so portable, but always been involved with technology through college and into law school. In fact, worked at the Center for Computer Assisted Legal Instruction, working with programmers on designing programs that would be interactions with the computer where people could do different learning courses. So I always had this kind of technology bent in the practice of law, did all sorts of different litigation endeavors from wrongful repos to commercial litigation. And in that, though, I had the opportunity in an environmental case to do some programming for trial exhibits and then proper sorting of those. And then it just kind of mushroomed with some involvement in tobacco litigation and others where we were working with a number of clients that had significant issues in terms of finding, retrieving, and producing documents and looking, and this is in the 1990s, at electronic data stores and how do you preserve and produce from there. So fortunately, because the cases I was involved in, we were dealing with this really ahead of the curve. So it kind of naturally tied in with my interest in computers that went back years and years. One of those fortunate endeavors where you find yourself in a good place where what you're doing matches what your interests and aptitudes are. So I'm very fortunate to have found a nice place where I practice.
Okay. So, David, since you've written books and books on privilege and e-discovery, where is the law on e-discovery privilege found, and then where is it heading?
Well, I guess it breaks down into two. In terms of, as a basic framework, the law of privilege is the law of privilege. It's no different for ESI than it is for anything else. It's just that the complications of applying it to ESI are more difficult. The law of attorney-client privilege is common law. It may be codified by state, but even there you have significant evolution in every state. And the work of the law of work product is rule-driven, and so you have the federal and the state rules that would apply. I think I'm going to interpret your question a little bit more broadly. I think where we are is that there are now enough tools established in the federal rules and then in many state rules that enable us to minimize the cost, both of review for responsiveness and for privilege, that I think people are becoming more aware of. And I know we're going to talk more about that, I think, later in the podcast. But I think with the 2006 amendments to Rule 26, which provided for things like clawback agreements among the parties, quick peek arrangements, Rule 16 amendments in 2006 that provide for comprehensive scheduling conferences, which enable the parties to anticipate and get court sanction for the treatment of ESI and discovery more generally, and also with regard to any particular issues that arise with regard to privilege, that those are tools that have existed now for some years. In addition, we have the Sedona Cooperation Proclamation and many of the other guidelines and best practices that Sedona has issued over the years, which provide guidelines. And the courts, in many cases, have brought into their opinions to encourage people to use and refer to. And then finally, we have Rule 502, which really is what has made it possible for the parties to rely on each of these tools in a way where they don't expose themselves to inconsistent outcomes in a different case with different parties. And that's 502D, which allows a court by court order to rule that something has not constituted waiver, and it's binding not just in that court but in all other federal and state proceedings, even with regard to third parties who are not before the court. Really a watershed moment, and I think if people really focus on the tools, and we're going to talk more about that, I think, then I think that there are ways that you can really manage this process. It's still going to be expensive. With regard to specific law on e-discovery, it's interesting. There are a few places where privilege and ESI are creating kind of unique areas of law. One of those, and there have been a number of cases on it, is where an employee corresponds with their lawyer on a company computer, either through the company's server or on a password-protected ISP. And the question is whether or not that's going to waive the privilege. And for the most part, and I don't know if we want to discuss it a lot, but for the most part, the courts have been forgiving of lower-level employees who really didn't know that that was impermissible. And the cases where the courts have found that that waived the privilege was with regard to more senior people who really are tech-savvy and had had access to the firm's policies and procedures and really knew better. So I think that's one place where the courts have sort of gotten to understand how ESI works and, you know, the human beings that interact with it, and I think are, for the most part, with some exceptions, coming to sort of human results in those cases. And as we're going to talk about later, that's not always the case with the handling of ESI in these cases.
So, Jonathan, David gave a little bit of an explanation on Rule 502. Not sure if you want to add to it. Feel free to, but definitely is a question that I'd like to address is why Rule 502 is still not overwhelmingly used. Do lawyers still need more training on how to use it effectively? But feel free to take a crack at that.
Sure. Well, as to the first point, I think David's kind of touched on the most important point, which is 502D. But just for purposes of background, 502, when it was implemented, had five basic areas that were covered: subject matter waiver, inadvertent disclosure, state court waivers, federal court orders, which is the 502D, and then confidentiality agreements between the parties. Subject matter waiver was really a critical component with respect to really getting a uniform rule for when there would be a circumstance that if you waived a privilege with respect to either inadvertent or deliberate, what's the scope of that? Does it affect other documents that weren't disclosed that were related to that subject matter? So 502A really deals with that. 502B is interesting because it deals with the inadvertent disclosure and making a uniform standard for that as well, but that's only if no one takes the time and bother to either come up with an agreement under 502E or, better yet, have a court enter an order that reflects the agreement, that then it becomes binding under 502D. But for those people that just don't avail themselves of E or D, there is a reason to look back at 502B as to, again, uniformity across now the federal system on that level. 502C, state court issues. And you know, 502D and E have their own provisions, but it's really back to that 502D, which allows you to really effectively have a court enter an order that basically will protect you, depending on how you word it, from practically any waiver. You can even have the dreaded quick peek where you don't even look at documents and the other side looks at them, selects, and then you do your privilege review, and either they've used a taint team or something else to limit the effect of the ringing the bell problem, and say that there's absolutely no waiver in that circumstance. 502D absolutely allows that. But what's interesting is the fact I was at a Sedona Conference Complex Litigation panel last week, and the judges up there, including Judge Grimm, are just mystified that this is not getting used. And not only are they mystified by that, they're also mystified by the fact that judges aren't getting the impact of 502D, that they are still thinking that even if parties have that agreement out there, well, you still have to show that all your steps are reasonable. You still have to demonstrate all the things that are in the law prior to 502, but certainly those things are set forth in 502B. Well, actually, that's wrong. And so some of the judges were involved in the drafting, notably, again, Judge Grimm, among others, have just pointed out what is going on with this. So they're thinking there might be a need for more education. Maybe it's that parties aren't really getting into understanding the value of cutting out the cost of privilege. From my perspective, I think that the clients are the ones, especially those who have a lot of data, that are losing out here if their lawyers aren't taking advantage of what the real power of 502 is to protect against loss of privilege, to actually facilitate more effective means to exchange information about documents that that could obviate the traditional privilege log. I mean, there's many things that 502 now basically enables, but only if people understand that it's there and then take the time to employ it in their cases. And so the bottom line is there's certainly a phenomenon here, Carl, that people are not using this rule. I don't think anyone's put their finger exactly on why. It's not the sexiest rule in the world, perhaps. There wasn't a big fanfare about it like there was about e-discovery rules, so that might explain some of it. But the bottom line is this is an underutilized rule, and the judges that are on the Rules Committee are concerned about that.
Mm-hmm. And if I could just add one thing, Carl.
Sure.
To me, I mean, two things with regard to issues that Jonathan just raised. One is 502A is the you and your client get to sleep well at night. You know that no matter how hard you try and you strive for perfection, that there's going to be error. 502A, except in the most unusual circumstances and really only where you're trying to game the system by using something to your advantage and not producing the rest. But in the vast majority of cases, if you happen to inadvertently produce a document, strike that. 502A makes it clear that inadvertent production never leads to subject matter waiver. If you voluntarily disclose a document because you think it's innocuous, it's a transmittal letter, or you've produced something that that you really don't care about, you're happy to have the other side have it so you don't have to fight about it later, it's not going to lead to subject matter waiver. So you're both protected from subject matter waiver by inadvertent discovery or inadvertent production, which is the key issue that people lost sleep over. And it also means that you don't have to make crazy assertions of privilege in order to fend off feared subject matter waiver. And that's, you know, right in the committee's comments, is that they found that parties were asserting things over, for example, transmittal letters that drive judges crazy when they see them in in-camera review. How could a vanilla transmittal letter be privileged? Well, Judge, I didn't want to waive the privilege as to everything else. Well, this prevents that. The second thing I would say in terms of the use of the rule is if you really understand it, and John, I want to highlight this point by Jonathan, is if you really understand it, you can do things. There's a great case out of Texas, the Whitaker case, where you had a really thorny problem. You had an underlying state court action. You had the client from that case fire his lawyer and then sue him in federal court for malpractice. And the lawyer then sought to discover what is now waived as between those two parties, that is privileged information relating to the engagement. And the client said, Judge, I need a stay because if I produce that, it's waived and it'll get used against me in the underlying case. And the judge made a very good use of 502D. He said, I'm going to hold that if you produce documents in this case, it shall not be a waiver in this or any other case. Produce them in a confidential way. You can't use them publicly in court, and we'll put off for another day at some point in the future if we have a trial and you have to use them publicly, we'll revisit how we're going to treat these documents. That was a great cost-saving, judicial resource minimizing result that you could not have done before 502D. And I've used that approach in a couple of cases. I've seen almost no one use that, and it does strike me as people are really missing a way to save their clients a lot of money.
So what can parties do to minimize the risk of handing over privileged information beyond Rule 502D?
Well, I mean, it's really how can they do it cost effectively is really the question.
Yeah.
I mean, in the old days, you'd get a bunch of associates and you look at every document, and even that would have error in it, but you'd have human input on every single page of every document in the universe of potentially responsive documents. Not only 502, but what technology allows us to do with ESI is to make informed decisions about how we can sort the data. First, and we can talk about this later, I suppose, but, you know, reach certain agreements with the other side about date cutoffs and, you know, who the custodians are we're going to look at and minimize the universe of data, but even then make strategic use of technology to bucket those things that are likely to be privileged and those things that aren't, and focus the majority of your attention on the bucket of things that are likely to be privileged, with, you know, obviously quality sampling of the rest, but that minimizes then what you're going to look at. And then, to me, one of the biggest things is at the very earliest part of the case, decide what rules you're going to apply as to what is privileged and what isn't. And it's funny because often you put people in either to sort documents technologically or more often people actually looking at documents, and you haven't identified by that point who all the players are. And if you're going to sort electronically or with technology, you have to identify who the players are and how they're going to appear in the ESI. You know, you identify all the lawyers' names, but how are their email addresses going to show up? You can identify a law firm's domain name, but are they going to use their personal computers as well? And, you know, did a person who happens to be a lawyer actually act as a lawyer? And did they always act as a lawyer? And we're going to talk more about that, I think, later in the podcast as well. But being really informed when you go in to sort the data and when you analyze it, sit down with the whole team so everyone understands what sort of the rules of engagement are and what is privileged and what isn't, and then agree to iterate that and inform the entire team as you change your mind about things, as you learn more, and find a way to kind of harness that knowledge on the team. So those are just some suggestions.
Right. Now, we talked when we were planning this podcast a little bit about the Vioxx case, and you know, you had some interesting observations about what that case teaches us about privilege. You want to share those?
Sure. And it's not just what it teaches about privilege, but the Vioxx case is the perfect example of where privilege and review of ESI come together, and where there's both potential mischief, cost, and also ways of, I think, resolving issues by category as opposed to document by document, which I know, Jonathan, you and Judge Facciola have written extensively about. In Vioxx, it was a multi-district litigation involving Merck's pharmaceutical Vioxx. In the course of that case, there were 1.8 million documents involved. Merck withheld 30,000 of them, which constituted 500,000 pages. There was an argument about whether or not the privilege had been properly asserted, and the judge actually physically reviewed 81 boxes of documents over the course of a year. His decisions on privilege were overturned by the Fifth Circuit, and so they hired Professor Paul Rice to act as a special master to review 2,600 of them on a sampled basis. And what distilled out of that was something very interesting. Merck had asserted privilege over many, many, many emails where a lawyer was only one of many who had been who had received distribution of an email. It was Merck's practice, and if you're a Six Sigma person, you think of this as sort of Six Sigma efficiency. All disciplines in the company were simultaneously sent a request for information or comment about an issue. The law, you know, the legal department, as well as marketing and contracts and all the other departments. And so it was not siloed, and then information came back. Now, that's very efficient from a corporate standpoint, but it means that legal and business were being mixed routinely. And what Merck said to the court had three theories for why all this stuff was privileged. One was that we're in a regulated industry, and almost everything we touch is potentially a legal issue, so we always need to get our lawyers involved. The second was a collaborative theory, is that, you know, we follow this collaboration approach, and everybody gets everything, and that's the way that you should really manage your business, and there's a legal component to all of it, and therefore all of it is privileged. And third was something called a reengineering theory. They said if we only withhold our lawyers' comments to documents, and we produce the original draft and the final version, will enable other parties to imply what the lawyer's comments must have been. And so we're going to reveal the substance of attorney-client communications if we produce all this stuff. Well, the court rejected all of it. what the court said was how you organize your business has direct impact on whether or not you're going to be able to assert the privilege. And you may choose to run your business in this efficient way, but if you do so and you simultaneously send emails to a lawyer and many other non-lawyers for their business input, you're going to have a very difficult time meeting your burden that those documents are privileged. The second thing the court said, and this is kind of a summation of several cases from the 1990s that in-house counsel has been very aware of, is the recognition that in-house counsel wears two hats in many cases. They're acting in a business capacity and a legal capacity, often with regard to the same transaction, and with the exclusion of pure litigation counsel in-house, you don't know simply by category, by identifying a lawyer in the legal department or elsewhere, whether or not that email or document is going to be privileged, because you can't answer the question just by identifying the author or recipient, whether they were acting as a lawyer. And the court said you have a duty to prove with a clear showing that a lawyer was acting as a lawyer and that your emails were for a legal purpose, primarily for a legal purpose and not for a business purpose. So, you know, this efficient approach defied really all the best practices that we recommend to our clients about how to maximize the protection of privilege. And the court said you can make that business decision, but it's going to cost you here. Most of this stuff isn't privileged. And I think the reason that it's important for the question of ESI and privilege is that Jonathan and Judge Pacciola make some very good suggestions about how we can bucket documents and treat privilege by category. But to me, the large quantity of what's going to be involved in a privilege log are these documents in-house with an in-house lawyer's name on them. And you really need to do analysis and perhaps some discovery about what the role of those lawyers were with respect to the specific subject matter that's involved, in the case. And I know, Jonathan, you and Judge Pacciola recommended that in order to kind of streamline the process, that you identify these things and that the party asserting the privilege would be expected to come forward with affidavits and that perhaps there'd be some limited discovery to just kind of kick the tires on whether the assertion of privilege is legitimate. But to me, this is the place where lots and lots and lots of documents get caught. And if you have an unscrupulous lawyer, or if you have a company that thinks if it puts its lawyer's name on everything, it'll be able to protect it, it makes it hard from a purely technical approach to properly bucket between privileged and not privileged.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And to that last set of points, I think the Fatiello-Redgrave framework, when you apply it to a situation where you're looking at the in-house lawyer documents, can you categorize? Well, actually, you could. So you could have a category of in-house lawyers who are on communications that are dealing with lawsuits and litigation-related communications. Even internally, you'd be like, well, that's more akin to the hat that they're always wearing as an advocate, as a counselor in their legal capacity. Well, you could separately bucket out perhaps the communications they had where they're copied on, they're going to the research and development. Well, we're saying, what's going on there? If it's really about how they're patenting ideas or things like that, that might be one thing. But if they're really commenting on where they should be doing the research or whether research is profitable or, you know, are there ways in which we can drill down to properly bucket where that's going to make a difference? Because you could say, well, within this bucket, those kind of communications predominantly are business and are not within the scope of an applicable attorney-client privilege that the law recognizes. Now, obviously, any categorization is going to be fraught with some level of peril, but I think it really can be done, and I think there are ways in which it's done defensively, and the way in which you do that is by having upfront discussions about what the categories are and are not, making sure you have sampling of those categories, and making sure that you have record evidence coming in appropriate times to demonstrate the bona fides of the categorization. So there's not one size cookie cutter, and in fact, the Fatiello-Redgrave Framework Law Review article in the Federal Courts Law Review really tries to set forth different tools that can be adapted and applied in different circumstances. And the important thing here is that there are these tools available. 502 really empowers the use of these tools in different ways. You can have now under 502, you could have a pretty frank discussion with your opponent under 502D, where you kind of share a little bit more under the kimono than you would otherwise, but you don't have the risk that you're creating any waiver of anything there. But then with the extra information that meet and confer, they can get a level of assurance and trust that the categories make sense. And then the categories allow you to perhaps list entire list of Bates numbers or something with one log description. You didn't have to spend a ton of money on it because everyone's basically agreed, you know, we might have a little bit of sampling on that, but, you know, it's not the big area of concern. And for others, it might be, don't even log those litigation documents. That's not where this is. But for the ones that were about R&D, for instance, or maybe a marketing, because those are the issues in that particular case, and there's a little bit of concern about what the role of the lawyers was, well, maybe we're going to have an initial tranche of document-by-document logging, or maybe we're going to do all of them in that category. But the thing is, we've focused our time, attention, money on those. And then we're going to focus the time and attention of the court or other judicial officer on those in terms of resolving issues and problems. And so the whole idea here is, how do you do this more effectively and efficiently? And I think there are ways, and, you know, the whole VIACS experience, I think, in the cases show us there are ways. This whole concept really isn't new, and Judge Fasciola and I have been very frank about it. We're not like we're new rocket scientists and came up with anything great. You can go back to the AT&T cases, Judge Greenhead in the District of Columbia, where there were these kind of approaches used. Certainly, I've been involved in tobacco cases where things were promoted and used. And I know the perils of this, and I know where you can get into problems if documents are in multiple categories and they're thrown out in one and they're found privileged in others. You've got to be very careful in the way in which you do this. You've got to make sure that the property rights of individuals or corporations are maintained. Because remember, privilege is a property right. So it's not something that can be lightly tossed aside. That said, given the countervailing concerns about burden and cost and those property rights, I think there's really ways for the creative and smart lawyers to really help their clients defend appropriate privileges and make sure that inappropriate things done by other parties are found out and that we've got a good check and balance on the system. And with that, if everyone understands that's what the goal is here, this is not a way to hide things, but a way to get to the truth faster, to properly preserve and protect privileges when they are properly asserted, and to cut out any silly, you know, assertions or lazy assertions, and to not just spend money on wasteless or just wasteful noise. All those things, I think, really have a recipe here for the smart lawyers, Carl, to really provide value to their clients. And I think, you know, for anyone that's really in this area, not just the Fasciola Redgrave framework, you know, that's the framework to kind of get this stuff. I really got to tell you, Carl, and this is a kind of maybe a shameless plug here, but it's my doing this, is that the lawyers really have to understand what the privileges are. So many times, and this is Judge Shinlin at the Complex Lit Seminar last week for Sedona, was noting how people just still don't understand and how they went through log after log and it wasn't right. And she was talking about in the Federal Rules Committee view that is there some way to incorporate this kind of concept there? But all this comes back to, they've got to understand, and David said this at the beginning, and this gets to my plug, you got to understand privileges. And the treatise that David has been involved in, and I think you're about to get into the fourth edition of this out later this year, this is what I have on my desk. This is what I use because I need to go back. I need to look at that and understand the different nuances. And it takes, you know, citations to know what jurisdictions you're in. And the differences between the different types of privileges that might be asserted by the government, they're different from the, you know, what a corporation can use and then what an individual can use. And so understanding these is critically important. I just can't commend to you enough David's publication.
Well, it's, you know, Jonathan, it's not a shameless plug if you plug somebody else's book.
So there you go.
Okay. So the next area to wade into, since we're hitting some pretty sensitive issues here, we can certainly weave the recent New York Times article in, especially when we're talking about categorization. So Jonathan, how do humans help with determining privilege documents, or was the New York Times article right? Software can replace people.
Well, I think I just gave you the answer and lead in there, softball number five, and that's the reality that you've got to understand privilege and what the case is about. You've got those two substantive elements as to which even Watson sitting there won't be able to figure that out. You know, it does take the lawyer's mind to be applied to the facts and circumstances to understand, you know, what are the claims, what are the defenses, where is this case going? Then also be able to understand what privilege law applies, and then that gets us to where Watson or any other technology can get involved and that is applying across a broad spectrum of data, the kind of rule set that might be developed on a categorization process, for instance, or any other guidance that you can give, rather than having 500 reviewers sitting in a room all eating pizza, drinking diet soda throughout the night, making suspect calls, especially as the diet soda gives way to beer. I've kind of talked with Wendy Butler-Curtis at Oric, about the sixth beer review, what really happens to review rates once the reviewers get to their sixth beer. When you just are looking at linear reviews for doing this, this is not the optimal situation. So, the New York Times article really talked about the ability to leverage technology to gain advantage in this space. It wasn't that the technology is replacing all humans or all lawyers, but there is a certain element here that there is a strata of legal staffing that isn't going to be needed in the future, because rather than having the 500 lawyers with their soda and beer, you can have a series of parallel processors that are going to be able to take rule sets and apply them consistently 24/7 to crunch through the data. Now, you do need a level of review that can understand the workflows. You need a level of review that can understand the data to be QCing what your computers are bringing back. But this is the new age. This is where tomorrow is. So I think the New York Times article was very helpful to kind of highlight this. And I think, quite frankly, there are going to be a lot of clients that are going to be sitting back over the course of the next 6, 9, 12 months looking at the quote-unquote traditional way that quote-unquote traditional firms do things and say, man, what am I paying for? Is this really the smartest way for me to spend my money to defend this company and make sure we're doing what the rules require? But are we doing this smart? Carl, at the bottom line, computers aren't replacing all the humans, but this is a paradigm shift. I think this represents a paradigm shift, and the whole world of how we deal with privileged documents is right in the thick of it.
Yeah, I just want to make it very clear that in my pre-review world with my old company, we had V8 and carrots. Okay, that's what was that was.
A wellness plan. Before anyone called it a wellness plan, Carl, you are truly a visionary as well as an entrepreneur.
Thank you. And that was the pre-review model. So anyway, that was the old model. So anyway. David, I think we may have – I don't know if you have anything else to add about complexities, about claiming privilege with email threads.
I just have two quick things. One is that in an email string where you have separate emails, each separate email is a communication, and you have to analyze the privilege with regard to each. And a subsequent forwarding of it to a non-privileged person may waive the privilege. So the key complexity is – figuring out a way not only to make sure that you review each communication, but also that you have a system that lets you know if it's been waived subsequently. The other thing is how to deal with attachments, and we don't need to go into all of that, but just giving a document to your lawyer doesn't make it privileged. And how you maintain awareness of what's happened to a document that happens to be attached to a privileged email, and you've deemed it privileged, but it may have appeared someplace else and it's not privileged, and just getting your arms around all that is a really thorny issue. And emails really are the bane of all of us, and Jonathan may want to comment on this. One of the biggest things technologically is that if an email gets forwarded from a BlackBerry, you're wiping out all the underlying metadata that enables you to quickly sort it and index it so that you make sure that you've got all the emails analyzed separately. So those are just some of the things that give you headaches with emails.
Yeah, and I think the reality is, depending on what device you're using, there can be complications for making sure you've actually found the families of emails and the threads of the conversations. And, now we're getting into a world of a lot of organizations not really in the Outlook environment. They might be using Gmail. They might be using, let's look 5 years down the road, they're going to be using Xylab or QuiLab or QLab. Mail, who knows what they're going to be using. And the reality is privilege law stands irrespective of technology. So what does this mean? Well, practically it means you got to talk with the other side about how you're going to log things or how you're going to identify things, even by category, what's in, what's out, what level of analysis are you doing. And it might be for some cases you're not going to get down to the level of every single email, or you might have some agreement about what you're going to look for. I mean, there's different ways in which to handle this, but the most important lesson, I would say, is make sure you're always on the same page in any litigation situation about how the parties are going to do it. Because we've seen cases where, you know, lo and behold, it's not until after the fact someone says, well, we only logged the first email or the last in the string without revealing that previously, and people were under assumption of a different set of rules applying, and then, of course, everyone races off to the judge, and, you know, 50-50, you might be a good day in court, you might be a bad day in court.
Before I ask the next question, I just want to clarify, David, you didn't go into detail in the attachments. Is that where you have to go buy the book to learn all the answers? After that plug that Jonathan gave you, was it just a little too complicated for 45 minutes?
Right. No, I would say you read my book. I have worked very, very hard on it, and I'm in the midst now of finalizing the manuscript for the fourth edition. So it would make me very happy if other people looked at it. So.
Great. Okay. Well, Jonathan, you were just talking about cooperation there at the end, and I know David mentioned a little bit, especially when we were talking about this show. We agree that cooperation is a useful tool to make privilege reviews less burdensome. You know, how does it work in practice, and how does it break down?
Well, it works in practice if people will understand what it means, that it's not a loss of their role as an advocate. It really is enhancing their role as an advocate for the client, that they're able to explain how their client is approaching the issues, how it's a defensible approach, and then that the ability to exchange information, frankly, with the other side allows for the creation of meaningful case management orders on a whole slew of issues, but including how you're going to handle privilege issues as well as disputes. And by doing this, you've set a framework for the most effective and efficient way to adjudicate the matters that are collateral, of course, to the ultimate matters in dispute that get to trial or some other resolution that the court might guide. So once you get to understand that cooperation isn't something that you should be running away from because it's giving away the state secrets, it really is a powerful and appropriate tool under the civil rules. It's not really about drinking all the Sedona Kool-Aid about the Sedona Cooperation Proclamation, but it really is understanding that, you know, that Kool-Aid is really pretty much plain water, and we all need water to survive. And really going forward with the volume of information, with the number of complexities there are with electronic data, if you think you're really going to make all the calls and balls and strikes yourself and not be subject to second guessing, you're nuts. If you can figure out that the land of cooperation allows you to involve at different levels other people in those decisions, so you've insulated yourself from the subsequent second guessing, man, you've done yourself an amazing favor. And quite frankly, I think that a lot of counsel, once you get them into the situation where they understand that each side is being, you know, fair brokers, honest dealers with their information, you can get to agreements. So, you know, Carl, you asked the question, well, where does it break down? It breaks down when there isn't trust, when the other side doesn't believe what you're saying, where you've kind of hid information, where you're only telling half a story and it comes out later, or they ask for, you know, some basic information that's not privileged that you should be able to share, but you hold back or you don't share, or it just, you come out with gobbledygook. Those kind of things destroy trust, and without trust, you can't have cooperation. And everyone will then this fight tooth and nail before the court. They'll file motion after motion, you know, and call each other names if it really gets down and dirty. But that's really the antithesis of cooperation, the lack of trust.
And, you know, we were talking about this, David, earlier. How do you, you know, create trust? How do you maintain trust? What do you do to maintain trust in a cooperative, you know, process?
Well, it's much of what Jonathan said. I think the first thing is if you and your adversary, your opponent, walk into a room and you're both really prepared and you're willing to, you know, disclose a lot about how data is stored, and you can trust what the other side is saying because it's detailed and it seems to make sense and they're coming across as a straight shooter, that's a great way to maintain trust. The great way to undermine trust is to walk in and make, you know, let's even give people the benefit of the doubt. They just were lazy. They didn't do their work. They walk in, they make, you know, broad assertions about how much it's going to cost, the burden, the inaccessibility, the this, the that, and you go, look, I know that's not true. And so you can't trust someone like that. Or you have someone who's, you know, a sharp practitioner, and you know they're trying to hide something, and I much prefer to work with people who I've worked with before who I can trust, and we aren't going to make each other's lives shorter, and there are people in the world that do. And And some of those you know from firsthand experience, and some you learn, you know, during the course of a case. And those are cases where, in order to defend your client's interest, you then have to spend money and pursue things because you know there's something behind, you know, door number three. And when you get behind door number three and you find it, usually if the court understands what's happened, you know, they're not going to be pleased. But it's sure a lot better if you can just walk in, as Jonathan said, get to the underlying merits of the case and not waste a lot of the client's money and time and energy worrying about the process of getting there. And that doesn't mean you roll over and you know, tell the other side what the theory of the case should be, but it's just being straightforward and knowledgeable, I think.
So, Jonathan, I mean, cases come in different sizes. Does the size of the case impact the privilege process?
Well, you're certainly going to have an aspect where it does influence the privilege process. I mean, if you're going to have a case where it's only one banker's box and you got like 10 documents that are privileged, you might have a 10-document privilege review, your 10-document privilege log. The reality, you might not have any logging at all. The party's like, this case isn't about that. It's about this contract, and, you know, it's about whether or not Bob did or did not, you know, steal the client list when he went to company B. So there could be plenty of situations where some of the things we're talking about come into play, even though it's a small case. At the same time, you might have a medium to larger size case where the circumstances are such that you're not going to be able to take as much advantage of some of the unique ways we've been talking about to avoid document-by-document logging. Although I would say, quite frankly, you shouldn't try to categorize a big or small case as ones where some of these tools do or do not fit. It really is a matter of understanding, you know, what is this case about? What are the issues with respect to privilege in terms of what documents are we going to withhold? And then communicating with the other side about, you know, what's the best way to handle this. In each case, you're going to know, I think, if you're a good lawyer and understanding, you know, what your facts and circumstances and the law are, you know, how hot an issue privilege is going to be. And then you address it appropriately. And then you go to the other side. You know, those cases where it's not a big deal, figure out ways in which you're going to be able to save time and money for everyone. Don't just run the mill to rack up fees and other things. Oh, we got to do a privilege log and just do it. When there's no issue, there's no chance it's going to be challenged. I mean, think creatively here. Spend the client's money well. I mean, the clients are expecting lawyers not just to be the legal advocate at any cost. They're willing to pay good money for good lawyers, but they expect high value. And I think in the litigation world, high value is embracing some of the new world of cooperation, embracing there are alternatives to the traditional way of doing document reviews, embracing the fact that there are different ways to approach case management issues such as privilege logs that yield the same or better results in the courtroom, but at substantially reduced risk to privilege and substantially less cost to the client.
The last thing I want to focus on is time. And Jonathan, doesn't the use or misuse of time, is that one of the factors which creates the biggest challenge to being iterative, especially when we're trying to work with the other side on privilege?
Well, you know, time is a factor, and in the sense that it does take time to iteratively create categories, what does that tell us? Well, you better get started early in the case. So when you're talking about a Rule 26F, you know, one of the issues that the rules were amended to highlight you should be talking about at the beginning is privilege. Why? Well, in the subtext of the rule, in the advisory committee notes, you can see is, well, you should be talking about whether some of the alternative privilege logging mechanisms that have been available, you know, by rule in the advisory committee notes in 1993, well, you should be talking about it. We should be talking about whether there's any unique privileges that might need to be briefed early so that there's resolution so everyone knows what the ground rules are for claiming it and what's going to be required for proof and whether or not you can bucket or categorize or otherwise deal with the groups en masse. So I think time is an enemy if you leave this to the end. And oftentimes in cases you'll see, oh, well, it's after the dates of production. Well, we're just going to deal with the privilege issues now. And lo and behold, then you get privileges overturned. And then lo and behold, hey, you know what? We need a supplemental deposition. Oh, well, the expert needs to do this. Now this information is available. And you've just thrown the entire schedule off track, which of all the things you can do to make a judge mad is throwing their schedule off track close to trial. So, you know, good case management, best practices case management says deal with privilege early because, again, as you noted in your question, Carl, there is an element, if we're doing this in this new world order, that's iterative. It's not like everyone goes off to their respective corners and comes up with a document-by-document log. If we're going to do these things that require cooperation, that require some level of innovation, there's got to be a grace of being able to tweak it, whether you're doing it through sampling, whether you're doing it through initial declarations you're looking at to help, you know, establish what the rules are for the categories or establishing what the law that's going to be applied in that case as to privilege is going to be. By giving enough time for that to work, you've given it a chance to grow and succeed. It's like a plant. You know, you don't expect your corn crop to grow tomorrow. You get to have a season. So deal with the privilege issues at the beginning of the case. If it's going to be one of those issues that has to be iteratively developed for the guidance, make sure you've built that into your case management schedule.
David, do you have anything to add to the time dilemma? Because, you know, one of the things I typically hear when it comes to time is what Jonathan said about a judge's reaction to something and saying you were going to get it done in a month, sorry, or, you know. So how do you deal with that when you know you're going to have to be iterative? Are there any things that you can do?
Well, I mean, the first thing is what judges don't like is for you asking for extent. I mean, many judges are forgiving on this, but what they don't like is to be told in the middle or toward the end of the case that you need some additional time. If at the very outset in your meet and confer for a Rule 26F conference, you discuss the need for phased discovery and you present it to the court in the initial scheduling order, then I think you're much more likely to get the court to agree to give you the time. I mean, some courts are willing and some aren't, but I think any court, if it's well thought out and well explained, is going to be at least initially sympathetic to people who seem to know what they're doing and they're adults and have actually thought about the case. So if you don't think about it until you're midway through discovery, it's a whole lot harder. The second thing I would say is that lawyers are deadline-driven. And if you have a notion of a phased discovery but you haven't set sort of internal deadlines in the order, you're likely not to get them done. So I think putting dates on things, understanding that they're going to be flexible within the overall discovery period, if necessary, but getting deadlines, and lawyers respond to deadlines. You know, Outlook reminders come up, it's 30 days to this particular internal deadline, I got to get that done. That's what's going to spur people to do it. So it's a combination of sort of old-fashioned management and getting the court to buy onto it early, I think are the best suggestions.
Great, and we've never done this on the show, but here at the end, since we've already shamelessly plugged your book and as a third-party tool, where do you find your book?
Well, I've got two.
The, you got to finish it, right?
That's right. Right. Well, Testimonial Privileges is a Wes Thompson book. It's third edition, 2005. It's been updated through 2010. The fourth edition, which will be dated 2011, will be coming out this fall, and it's available through Wes Thompson. And then internally, I've got my blog, which I update every month, which is available on our website, and I've also got sort of an internal shorter outline that I provide to people who'd like that as well. And if anybody wants to contact me, they can do that here at Jenner and Block.
And for everyone that gets angry that's been on the show and say, hey, I wrote things and no one ever plugged that, I think we found the loophole. You get the other guests to talk about what a great device. I'm not going to plug it, but if the co-guest does.
Well, you know, the only caveat to that is it's got to be a damn good work product, and it is.
So, anyway, with that in mind, I just want to thank you both, Jonathan and David, for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y, and we have a complete list of our shows there. You can also remember our show, our website phonetically. It's EasyBytes. That's the way it sounds out of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.